Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, we're live recording from the Choose Food Symposium in Baltimore, Maryland. This is a gathering to evaluate some of the core ethical questions of food. Issues like labor, environmental impact, externalities, animal welfare, health risk factors, and new tech are all on the docket of the discussions of ethics. This is a culmination of through the efforts of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and the Johns Hopkins Center of Livable Future, the CLF. It's an effort and an opportunity for leaders in diverse fields to meet and to discuss the current state of food and its production through a broader and more holistic perspective of what is right. Today, we're joined by one of these leaders to discuss the role of industry in these questions of ethics, to look into how food ethics plays into our culture and society, and what tomorrow will bring on a shrinking planet in need of a new plan for better managing our natural and regenerative resources. Today, we welcome Maisie Gansler from Bon Appetit Management Company. Hey, Maisie, how you doing?
Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure, and thanks for taking the time. You had a busy docket today. You presented, you moderated a panel, you're in taking care of business, and now spending some time with us. So thank you.
My pleasure.
So let's talk about this. I'm going to read a bit of your background in Bon Appetit and then jump into the questions. Okay. All right. So Maisie Gansler is the Chief Strategy and Brand Officer for Bon Appetit Management Company, an on-site restaurant company offering full food service management to corporations, universities, museums, and specialty venues. Based out of Palo Alto, California, the company operates more than 1,000 cafes in 34 states for dozens of marquee clients. Maisie has been instrumental in shaping the company's strategic direction, and she helped develop the Farm to Fork as well as several other sustainable initiatives and purchasing policies. The company, as I just learned, has $1.4 billion in revenue, and I love your tagline, which is Food Service for a Sustainable Future. Maisie, please tell us a little more about your role at Bon Appetit and some of the impact that you've had in the last 24 years.
I have the great pleasure of overseeing many departments that we think add up to creating the Bon Appetit brand. So marketing, communications, culinary, purchasing, wellness, and guest-facing technology, all things that we think make us uniquely Bon Appetit.
Yeah, I think it's exciting when you have an organization of your size, like we said, $1.4 billion in revenue, and that's substantial. And focus on some of those practices that we talk a lot about in Sourcing Matters, which is elevated production models, and focused on really looking at improving the lives of your farmers, focusing on your consumers, and working with those diverse stakeholders throughout your supply chain. How did that focus come about? And what is your responsibility in dealing with that supply chain?
When we were founded in 1987, it was about bringing restaurant quality food to the institutional marketplace. And at that time, we weren't thinking about words like sustainability or social responsibility, but we were talking about great flavor. And to have great flavor, you need great ingredients. We've always cooked from scratch. We don't use a lot of salt, sugar, fat to boost flavor. We want the ingredients to really sing. Mm. And about 1999, we had what we've termed a crisis of flavor on the plate. Food just didn't taste the way food used to taste. Mm. A lot of us have memories from our childhood, food memories, right? They're sensual. They stay with you. And I can remember growing up in California, or if you grew up in a place like New Jersey, that you could take a tomato and you could bite into it like an apple. And how many of us today would walk into a supermarket and bite into a tomato? It just doesn't taste the way it used to taste. And so we looked into that, and we found that tomatoes were being bred to travel. that they needed to sit on supermarket shelves without bruising and look as bright red as possible and shiny, but people weren't talking about the flavor. And that sounds really obvious today with the local food movement and all the focus that we have on local farms. But if you put yourself back into the late 90s, that was really an aha moment for us. And so we started thinking about, well, where do we get local produce? And we all had these ideas of, oh, there used to be a farm stand on Arrastradero Road in Palo Alto. Oh, I grew up with people who were farmers. And we went to those places, and they were all gone. And that's when we started to realize that if we wanted to have great-tasting food, we needed to invest in rebuilding the local food system. That was the birth of Farm to Fork, which has since gone into many other initiatives.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting because you said 1999, no one was talking about this. And what I find intriguing, to your point, your anecdote about, you know, the way food used to taste. And you'd hear that from different generations, right? Like, oh, this pork doesn't taste like, when I was a kid, it tasted differently.
Or, well, pork wasn't white meat.
That's right.
Pork did taste different.
That's right. And it was, you know, what we've considered pork, a very gelatinous and kind of, as we say, if we talked about, I want to talk about the gestation crates, definitely. But it was a different flavor profile, mouthfeel, everything was completely different. And tomatoes being a good example of that, the idea of the tomato being like the styrofoam now, right?
Right.
Yeah, and there's no, and you know, there's some, I think our olfactory senses, we taste about 10,000 flavor profiles, some outrageous amount, or maybe it's 2,000. I could be giving it a show, but for the purposes of the show, we're going to go with 10,000, some astronomical amount that can't even be replicated by modern science. We have such sophisticated profiles that maybe we've been trained out of that for so long, but corporations like yours, your organization, are really coaxing that back and really bringing it into not just the white tablecloth restaurant, but bringing this to scale and looking at it as opportunities so that if I have a kid that's going to college or I go to a ball game, I can enjoy that experience of good quality food like grandma used to make, right? Grandma's kitchen, that deliciousness. So let's talk a little more about the impetus of Farm to Fork. So started in 1999, Bon Appetit Farm to Fork, Farm to Fork initiative buys meat, vegetables, and other products within a 150-mile radius. In fact, I've read that 20% of your company's purchases meet that criteria. Maybe that's even low now.
20% is our annualized goal nationwide. So you can imagine that in California in September, we're well above 20%, right, and that in Minnesota in January, we're below 20%.
Absolutely. I think it also goes to that theme that you have flexibility in your supply chains to meet those standards. We have seasonality within production areas, within population densities, and that you've built infrastructure to be supportive of that. Again, is we'll go further than that in a minute here. But so additionally, you also focused on food waste for your clients involved in those programs and worked on composting each week and distributing to those area farms, returning back that sequence of closed loop energy back into our best ecological systems from food. So it seems like this is a good example of commitment to food ethics as a whole. And again, the theme that we're here with Choose Food is around food ethics. So let's talk more about that. So this is a positive business results that are coming from these food ethics. Can you tell us a bit more about the program, how it evolved, and maybe how those right methodology of doing the right thing has turned into more business for Bon Appetit?
You mentioned that in the late 90s, nobody was talking about these issues. And in fact, even when we started Farm to Fork, we didn't talk about it. We thought that guests would notice the difference in the taste of the food, and therefore they would enjoy the food more, come more often. We didn't think that they'd want to know the story behind the food. Of course, today, everybody wants to know the story behind the food. Everybody's seen the Portlandia sketch of, you know, going to visit the chicken before you order the chicken dinner. And I certainly do live in a somewhat of a Portlandia world,
I
admit.
As do I, yes.
But at the beginning, we really thought it was just about flavor. It was a culinary act, not a political one. As I said, we learned that we had to be active in rebuilding the food system to ensure those great flavors, and that extends beyond farmers. It goes to fishermen. If we want to have a wide variety of flavors of seafood available to us, we need to be mindful of the types of seafood that we're buying. That led to a partnership with Seafood Watch. we want to be cognizant of the flavors of the meat and the type of meat that we're buying. We've worked with the Humane Society of the United States for years. So everything for us started with flavor, but quickly got into the entire supply chain and then the ethics of it, as you have noted.
It's a challenging thing to then take a step back and make it a holistic perspective, right? Because when you're dealing with a supply chain for a organization that's $1.4 billion, you're putting out fires all the time. And I know you deal directly with the executive leadership team in your organization for setting strategy, for looking at this. So how, in your organization's scope moving forward, how do you continue, as the interest is there around farm to fork, you're developing scale with small farmers, not hobby farmers, mm-hmm. but really building out infrastructure. How can you continue to proliferate that and continue that leadership role so you get more groups looking at this and growing your business around those core ethics?
Well, I really run two different supply chains. One is that small farm to fork chain. And as much as possible, we keep that relationship between the farmer and the chef. So we try to get corporate out of that relationship mm-hmm. and let the person that's growing the food talk to the person that's cooking the food, who will talk to the person that's eating the food. I really believe that that relationship needs to stay as local as possible. And yes, we have guidelines around food safety and things of that nature, but beyond that, I want that chef and that farmer to own that relationship. Then I'm running a more conventional supply chain. You mentioned our scale. We do buy from large agribusiness, from large producers. And I think that actually creates opportunity for us to drive ethics into that scale of business as well. If I am a large customer with a seat at the table with a big agribusiness, I have a much better chance of getting them to make a change than if I'm a outsider just rabble-rousing at the doors. Right, I can talk with my dollars.
Yeah.
So I think that we have to bring our ethics to both.
Absolutely, and I think having a vested interest in there, being able to have a seat at the table where they're going to have that conversation, and maybe a good use case of that, or maybe you can explain to us, during your presentation, you gave a great list of things and programs you've been involved in, and those initiatives of really pushing the envelope, moving the needle here from the small farmers up to much larger supply chains. You had mentioned dealing with gestation crates and pork. Can you tell us a little bit about what your role was, and I think it was 2014 timeframe, and how you've seen that develop over the last few years?
Yeah, so you talked about putting out fires. There are certainly a lot of fires in the gestation crate pork story. We made a commitment to move to gestation crate-free pork. So for those people who aren't familiar with the term, a gestation crate is a pen that a pregnant sow is kept in for their entire pregnancy. And a sow's pregnancy is 3 months, 3 weeks, and 3 days, essentially 4 months. And the pen is so small that they can't turn around. They can only stay looking forward, looking at their feed, and eating more. No additional calories are wasted by silly things like moving. Walking.
Ooh, who needs that stuff?
Right.
Right, of course.
So we committed to moving away from gestation crates in our pork production. Our existing pork supplier, a very large company, made the commitment alongside us that they were going to eliminate gestation crates from their supply chain. We were happy to see the change in the big guys. I think it's really important for those big guys to make even incremental changes that impacts the largest number of animals. We moved forward with rolling out a bacon product that we thought was gestation crate free. Several months into the process, we learned that they were actually leaving the sows in the crates until the confirmation of pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about 28 days, about a month. So again, a sow is pregnant for 4 months. A quarter of that time, they were still in the crates. And I said, I don't think that's gestation crate free.
Yeah.
It's better than being in the crates the whole time, but I don't think that's gestation crate free. I don't think that's the right thing to do. We had many back and forths with this company about whether it was or was not the right thing to do. As you can imagine, they had a whole list of studies showing that sows like gestation crates, and I had a whole list of studies showing that sows don't like gestation crates. I finally said, the only person that I believe to be truly objective in this argument is Temple Grandin.
Yeah.
If you can get Temple Grandin to say it's better for the sows to be in the crates for that first month, then I will continue to buy from you. If you don't, then I'm going to pull all purchases.
Wow.
Since I'm telling the story, you can imagine Temple Grandin sided with me. Or, more importantly, Temple Grandin sided with the sows.
Absolutely.
Right. That is her interest.
Yeah.
The sows.
Yeah.
That left me in a bad position. I had publicly said that we were gestation crate free on our bacon. I had talked to our partners about it. And so my first phone call was to my partners at the Humane Society of the United States to say, hey, this pork that we thought was gestation crate free, it's debatable, we're talking semantics, but I don't believe that that is a definition of gestation crate free. This was not huge news to HSUS. They certainly knew about this practice, but they agreed that it wasn't as good as could be done. That sent us on a multi-month national search for pork at scale that would be what I consider gestation crate free. We called all our farm to fork vendors and said, can you guys ramp up? And we got answers like, we could do two more sows next month, you know, just not the scale that we need for serving 250 million meals a year. Important, but not going to be my mainline pork supplier. My contact at HSUS, Josh Balk, who I've worked with since 2005, had met a pork producer called Clemens Food Group that had a line called Farm Promise, where they only have the sows in crates for insemination.
Okay.
So they bring the sows into a crate, they bring them into heat, artificially inseminate them, and then the difference is they immediately move them into group housing. They don't wait for confirmation of pregnancy. So depending on how quickly the sow comes into heat, it can be as few as 3 days, as many as a week that they're in the crates. Much shorter time. Clemens is not a farm-to-fork supplier. They are a large producer. We're talking industrial-scale agriculture. But I think that's really important because what Clemens proves is that in industrial scale, you don't have to keep sows in gestation crates. And they also don't use antibiotics or ractopamine. So they're proving that in industrial scale that you can have clean conditions, better conditions for the sows, and they would say, to them most importantly, better conditions for their workers, because workers like being in a place where the animals are happier. Workers like being in an area with more light. Workers don't want to work in confinement operations either. That's all being done at industrial scale. So I'm very proud of those small farm-to-fork vendors that are Food Alliance certified, that I've been to farms and you see the pigs running around and it is that pastoral image that you want to imagine is how animals are raised. But I'm also proud of our industrialized pork partner, Farm Promise, and what they're doing.
Yeah, you're putting your money where your mouth is, and good for you.
And it did cost a lot more money.
Of course it did. And I mean, you put yourself out there to also take accountability for making certain declarations, making proclamations about your supply chain and saying, well, we can do a couple things. And most often, up until maybe modern history, maybe recent supply chains, most large industries would have just swept it under the rug. Again, I think that's sort of a unique identifier for what your organization and what you specifically have done on that commitment to making declarations and having that integrity behind that supply.
It touched off a series of articles in the Des Moines Register and in Meeting Place magazine about how what I was saying was wrong, to the point that my mom says, I don't think you should go to Iowa.
And did you ever think as a kid you'd be this excited about hog houses and all that? Probably not.
Never.
Well, how did you get into this, by the way? What was your impetus for getting into food systems and large-scale food systems and starting to look at solving some of these large-scale problems?
I got my first restaurant job at 14, working in the kitchen of Scantriano's Dolphin Restaurant at the end of the wharf in Santa Cruz, California. So restaurants is where I've always been. I've been lucky enough at Bon Appetit to be able to bring my values into the workplace. And I think that's a reason that a lot of us work at Bon Appetit, is that if we care about something deeply, that's reflected in our work. So as I've been with the company since 1994, as I've become interested in things, I've had the great luxury to be able to explore it and then to move the purchases of a large corporation. So it's really been an evolution.
Hmm. Are you seeing in this evolution the change of consumer or citizen awakening to this? Have you seen, you know, not just that the fact that you're servicing the needs of your buyers, but are you getting direct impact from some of the consumers or their consumers that are showing and expressing to you more than just anecdotal evidence that, wow, this is a macro trend happening and we're on to something? You're ahead of the curve.
Absolutely. In 2004, we put together our marketing program around these issues. As I said, when we first started Farm to Fork, we didn't think anybody would care about the story, really. So it was 2004 that we did the big marketing push. We realized that there was something that consumers would care. And we did a national roadshow for all of our chefs and managers. And we said, go out, make relationships with farmers, talk about it with your cafe guests. And at that point, we had this groundswell of good feeling that people felt as culinarians and hospitality professionals that they wanted to cook like this. But for the most part, there was some hesitancy to think that customers would care. And then we heard, well, maybe people in universities will care, but corporate America doesn't care. That was 2004. Today, when we get requests for proposals, there is never a request for proposal that doesn't ask questions about sustainability. It absolutely has become assumed to be part of the service we should provide. Now, the different level between what we do and what some other companies do, we hope is still a differentiator, but everybody has to be talking about this today because consumers and clients care about these issues.
Yeah, we've seen the same, and being able to get quite a bit of feedback from the different episodes that we've hosted and hearing this, at first I was, and I'm sure you look at it too, I was like, this is just confirmation bias, right? Mm-hmm. You can always go prove any point you want and go find anecdotal evidence to back it, sure. But it does seem to be in kind of inching its way into everyday conversation, into the general press. And what I find also intriguing is, you know, I've always looked at the food and the well-being associated to food, of eating good food, well-sourced food. That's a natural, right? It's preventative care for yourself, mm-hmm. and maybe layers deeper is that it's, I care about what happens to the environment. But the fact that we have people that are now wondering and concerned with the laborers around animal welfare practices does, at least from my perspective, and maybe this is confirmation bias, but it does seem that we have awoken to this idea that our food can be an agent of change.
There are very few things that we do as often as we eat. Mm-hmm. And the good news and the bad news about the food system is that it has incredible power and impact. 1/3 of global greenhouse gas emissions come from the food system. That's horrific in many ways, but it also means that all of us have a decision that we make every single day that can help prevent climate change or stem climate change. Most of us are not going to buy a new car this year. Mm-hmm. Many of us don't have control over the light bulbs that we sit beneath. But we all make food choices every day. And I think that many people are looking for ways to make impact in our world when we sometimes feel powerless. Food is a way that we can exercise our power in a very meaningful way.
And it's interesting, we had Mary Nessel on talking about that. She has that, she coined the phrase, vote with your fork. She also talked about voting with your vote. And as we sit here on November 6th, important discussion there in itself.
Yes.
But voting with your fork, it is something we do daily. And it's usually a little more expensive. But what it seems to be happening is that correlation of food values is getting to the consumer. And as industry, especially progressive industry, being a vessel of where the industry or the consumer's perspective is headed, You know, as we talked about here at Choose Food Conference, we have been discussing the philosophies, the policies, and the practice of industry. Is it going to be industry that's going to change food because they're listening to the consumer?
I'm not a big believer that government is going to save us all. I think that industry has to. Now, there are some things that I think government needs to get involved in. I think that anything that is a multinational issue, such as slavery and seafood, we really need government involvement. I am so far away, even as a purchaser of my size, from the boats that are literally not coming back to shore for 7 years. There's tuna boats that, because of transshipment, they just transfer their haul to another boat that brings that tuna to shore. I don't know how to exert the pressure that I need to ensure that there's no slavery in that supply chain. I need government action there for sure, and multinational government action. But in terms of many of the food issues, I think industry can lead, and government just doesn't move fast enough. We need to be able to correct these things on our own.
Yeah, and as we've seen, government can take some vested interests. Citizens United is pretty impactful in our approach, in our commitment to conventional agriculture, where we have we're starting to demystify some of those conversations, but we've pulled many of the values out of the food for looking at one barometer of what a successful food system is, and that's price. Mm-hmm. You know, in the States, what we spend 5 to 6% of our discretionary income on our food, which is half of what some of the other countries are. And those unintended consequences are poor general health, where our GDP is now committed, 16, 17, 18% towards our reactionary health care program. Are you seeing your consumers, your buyers, getting that perspective? Are they getting the idea that food is preventative care? Not only is, and I get the idea, it's taste. Taste is what's going to get you coming back. That's retention. That's where people are going to spend a little more for this. But are they also making that correlation from your perspective that maybe I shouldn't eat the hot dog with the products I have no idea where it's coming from, and maybe I'll look at something that is raised with pork that is not from gestation crates, overuse of prophylactic use of antibiotics, because, boy, I don't want my 7-year-old eating that.
Yeah, one of our big markets is corporate food service. And what every corporation would love to be able to do is see the connection between serving healthier food and lowering their healthcare costs. Everyone's concerned about healthcare costs in this country. It's a hard correlation to make, partly because in most cases, we're only serving people at lunch in a corporation. Can we impact their food choices enough at lunch to impact their health? I think the way we can do that is through education. Education both in terms of an experiential education, meaning that they eat something in the cafe that's delicious and craveable and happens to be healthy, and then they are more likely to cook that at home or order it someplace else now that they've experienced a wonderful healthy meal. More traditional education in terms of providing materials. We have websites for every cafe that has a huge amount of wellness information on it, both planetary wellness as well as personal wellness. And then can we get that information beyond the employee to their family? We have a program called Healthy Kids in the Bon Appetit Kitchens, where we actually invite people to bring their children into their workplace, and we run cooking classes for kids. And it is about the most adorable thing you've ever seen. So people are waking up to those ideas, but there is still the lure of salt, fat, and sugar, right?
It plays at some natural trigger points that we have, right? It's like a rolling upon a strawberry field every day of the year when you hit a soda machine, right? It hits those deep-driven things of fatten up on the sugar when it's there.
Right. And so we've played around with some ideas. We haven't hit on the right one yet, but things like getting people to make their food decisions before they enter in the cafe, because you're more likely, we think, to make a healthier choice when the French fries aren't in front of you. Or can we set the cafes up physically in a way to encourage people to make the healthier choice? We actually changed the layouts of our menu boards to look at behavioral economics. Can we nudge you towards the healthier choice? It turns out labeling something as the healthy choice discourages people from ordering it. So can we actually position it on the menu in a way that you're more likely to see it first and have your eyes drawn to it? Those nudges towards health.
You'd mentioned education being essential, and I completely agree. I also want to talk about education from a different lens, where it's 50% of your business and selling to education or academia. Mm-hmm. And what's exciting about that is we've got universities in the Northeast like UMass and UNH that have come out and said they have students that are now picking that college because of a food plan. When I went to school, you didn't think about that stuff. You just went and whatever had the most volume you would then consume, right? It wasn't the same perspective. The fact that sea changes happen as a collective is exciting, that this could be one generation away from that. How are you working on educating education?
The education marketplace is a lot of fun. Students are passionate and they're trying out their ideals and they're pushing boundaries and they're spending all this time in class learning about things theoretically that we can be the living example of. So it's a really fun place to be. And we put together a program called the Bon Appetit Management Company Fellows, where we actually hire recent college graduates who were activists on campuses that we serve, and they spend 1 to 2 years traveling the country holding sustainability education events on college campuses. And the idea behind it is that it's peer-to-peer education. So they went to schools that we served. They are not that far removed from the audience they're talking to. And they can say, I was in your seat 2 years ago, and this is what I was surprised to hear. Or I tried to start a campus farm on my campus, and here's what I learned. It's a very different conversation than me coming in as the corporate executive and talking from the mount about what our corporate philosophy is. But hopefully somebody that they can have a real authentic conversation with, ask all the tough questions, do it in their space, on their terms. And it's been a really fantastic way for us also to get information flowing back to us. Every time the fellows do a visit, they send a recap, including questions they were asked. And it helps me know where college students' minds are. Are we getting a lot of questions about animal welfare? Are we getting questions about GMOs? What's resonating with them? So it's a two-way education.
Interesting. Yeah, it's I can gain the idea of authenticity behind that, and the values of having that peer-to-peer relationship are essential. And being able to then capture that and do some analysis on that gives some validity for where you're going to move forward with next.
But it's the only thing that we could do that could ever be called consumer research. We don't buy any reports. We don't look at any other data. It's about what conversations people are having.
It's exciting when we do see the youth being this connected to where their food's coming from. And we've seen those trends in, even in returning back to producers and people that want to get connected with land and actually come through education or university or higher ed programs and want to become farmers, technically proficient farmers.
We started a network called Campus Farmers, and it's campusfarmers.org. There's two tracks, college campus farmers as well as corporate campus farmers, because a lot of corporations now have gardens on their campuses. It's open to anybody. You don't have to be associated with Bon Appetit in any way. We want it to be a resource for anyone that's interested in growing onto their campus. And many of them are gardens that are really demonstration, and some are production farms, both.
It's and I'll look at it from the industry side and say, this is all positive things, because those students also become the best advocates for coaching their parents along, mm-hmm. because they have that inside stake of saying, look, mom, let's not source that type of food. Here's why. Here's what I learned in school, right? You're getting your money's worth.
Absolutely.
Learning about a future food system and sustainable programs.
Surprise, mom, I'm a vegan.
We used to, I was involved in a private equity fund, and we used to go into conversations with investors that were a little more senior. And we would always, we learned to ask those questions. Do you have any children or grandchildren that are vegans or vegetarian? Anybody that's caring about the food systems? Because we had to have someone else. We had to have someone setting the stage for us, because just flying blind in those conversations, it's challenging in a boardroom to have an hour conversation and convince people the value of foods. You had mentioned partnerships with some of these students and also engaging students in these programs. But you also focus on other partnerships, broader partnerships, and not doing this just by yourself, finding other organizations, NGOs, public groups that are focused on that. Some include the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch, Humane Society, the Center of Livable Future right here at Johns Hopkins. How have those partnerships with these diverse stakeholders been so important in promoting your goals and promoting a broader food values and ethics across the board?
The partnerships are really, really invaluable in a couple ways. First and foremost, as much as we try to educate ourselves within Bon Appetit, our business is really to make lunch every day. I will never know as much about seafood as the people with PhDs at Seafood Watch. So having them as a resource for me to be able to try ideas out on, to understand complex issues, seafood in particular, there are so many species and so many places in the world that those species are being fished or farmed, and the information seems to be rapidly changing. I can't stay on top of it by myself. So having access to the science team at Seafood Watch just extends my knowledge base exponentially. They also are my touchstone for what's happening next. When I had implemented our cage-free egg policy, we started that in 2005, I then talked to the Humane Society. I call up Josh Block and say, hey Josh, what's the next thing you guys are working on? I want to have a relationship with those advocacy groups that I'm working hand in hand with them versus that they feel that they have to come and lobby or protest us. I don't want to be dragged into sustainability. I want to be leading the way. And having people by my side who are thinking about these issues day in and day out, who are expert in them, is really, really critical.
Critical, and it gives you that ability to be on it, to be have that perspective of, like you said, what is next. And during your presentation, you had mentioned something in your supply chain. Most recent initiative, it seemed, we've talked about on the show a few times, the idea of the citizens awakening around plastic in the oceans. And this has been a kind of a broad trend. And you shared with the audience here about your initiative to ban plastic straws. But it also ties in, you learned something about your supply chain that was something you didn't expect, and that you had to take a step back, be a bit nimble, and appropriately react to that. Could you share with our audience a bit of what that ban on straws led to?
Yeah, we became the first national restaurant company of any type, food service or otherwise, to ban the use of plastic straws. And the reaction was overwhelmingly positive and really exciting. Our people were excited, because I do think that all of these sustainability initiatives also create great morale boosts internally. And we were getting kudos from Greenpeace and feeling great about it. And then we started getting a couple of emails from people with disabilities who actually need plastic straws physically. And I had written into the policy that even the place that we got rid of straws completely, there would be straws available, but they were going to be paper straws. And the thing that I learned is that paper straws, in order to hold up in liquid, have been made very rigid. And people with certain disabilities need a flexible straw that is both bendable and biteable, that they can, that will then retract back into the shape of a straw. And a paper straw doesn't meet that qualification. And our intention was to do something great with the plastic straw ban. It was certainly not to create additional burdens to those with disabilities. But we learned along the way that that was an unintended consequence. So we actually partnered with a disability advocacy consultant to recreate the policy, to adjust it in order to keep plastic straws on hand for those who physically need them. I also learned to say people with disabilities or disabled people, not people with special needs or any other euphemism. These are the things that we learn that I'm happy to have the opportunity to learn.
Yeah, it's a constant experience. That's what life's about, right?
Is to absolutely
always learn new things. Well, I'd love to give the opportunity for our audience to learn more about Bon Appetit. Is the website the best location? Who are some of your partners that they can find your food? Where can we find this information, Maisie?
The website is www.bamco.com, B-A-M-C-O, like Bon Appetit Management Company. And you can find our food in many corporations and private colleges, but those are not always open to the public. So best to steer you to our public venues, the Art Institute of Chicago, the Getty Center in LA, Seattle Art Museum, Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth, Cleveland Museum of Art, AT&T Park, home of the San Francisco Giants, several restaurants in the San Francisco area, but go to bamco.com and that is your best entree into the world of Bon Appetit.
And maybe Stephen Curry will be eating your food as well soon enough.
In the Chase Center in 2019. Absolutely.
That. We can start feeding our players with the delicious and well-sourced food.
Not eating at Aisha's restaurants.
That's right. Well, he's vested in many other spaces, right? He's all over. Yes. Well, that was a wonderful conversation. I can't thank you enough for partaking in today's chat and for your great presentation earlier. It is exciting to see when we do have food service for a sustainable future at your scale, focused on some of these initiatives that we care greatly about, the food values associated with a future sustainable planet that we're all involved in. And the fact that we can vote with our fork and be involved in these conversations is an exciting evolution that only can happen in the modern day of a supply chain. So thank you so much.
Thank you for educating people about it. It's an important topic. I'm glad people are discussing it.
As am I. Well, thank you so much, Maisie Gansler, and until next time.